You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sylvia Arthur. She's talking to me from Ghana. Sylvia, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Sylvia, let's begin with what you're doing in Ghana and what your current project is, as a way of listeners understanding a little bit about your practice and what it is you've also created. What are you doing at the moment?
Okay, so I've been in Ghana more or less for the last 18 months. I moved here from London. I was born and raised in London, but my parents are from Ghana. And it had been a long-held dream of mine to open a library here because I've always been a reader since a very young age, I would say around 3 years old. I had accumulated about 1,300 books, which I could no longer accommodate my apartment in London. And a while ago, in 2010, I moved to Brussels for work, and I couldn't accommodate the books in my apartment in Brussels either. So I would ship them back to my mum's house in Kumasi, which is the second city of Ghana. The capital is Accra, and the second city is Kumasi. And every time I would go and visit my mum, I would just see all these books sitting there, and they would be, well, they were being unread. And I just used to think, this is such a waste that, you know, people aren't being able to access these books and get the same pleasure from them that I did. It was back in around 2011 that I had the idea to do the library, but it took me 6 years to actually come round to doing it. So that's what I've been doing here for the last year and a half or so. And as well as it being a library, it's also a hub. We do lots of events with writers from around the world who they come and they read. But also we do a lot of outreach work to try to stimulate and encourage a love of reading amongst particularly children. So we do lots of outreach. We do lots of events, and it's an exciting place to be right now.
That is very exciting. So I have a few questions. The books that you've been reading, that you've been collecting, the 1,300 books that were in your apartment that are part of your library since, I guess, you were very young. What kind of books are they? Are they largely about the arts or all over the place? What is it that you've been reading for the last, few decades or more?
Yeah, it's I'd say it's a very varied collection. Most of the books were actually collected from about 2010, but some of them, a small collection, are from maybe about 20 years ago or so. And it's very varied. I'm personally a narrative nonfiction reader. That's my genre. But when I decided to do the library back in 2010, I purposely started buying books to diversify the collection that I thought that other people would be interested in. So I would say we have lots of narrative nonfiction, which includes narrative travel writing, but also includes a lot of reportage and current affairs. We also have lots of fiction, and we have fiction from around the world. The key thing about the library is that we focus on writers of African descent, so writers from the African diaspora, including African, African-American, Black British, African European, African Caribbean, and that's the main focus of the work in the library. When I started, initially a lot of people would come in and ask whether we have any children's books, and I didn't have any at the time because I don't have any children. So in the last year and a half, I've put a lot of effort into getting children's books, and what's been interesting about that is trying to find children's books that are culturally relevant to children in Ghana. So for myself, when I was growing up, I would say that the majority of books that I read were African American, which is fine in a Black British context. But actually, when you come to Africa and to Ghana in particular, you realize that there's a disconnect between those kind of books and the books that children can actually relate to. So it's been a learning experience all around.
And just to get the timeline on this, so in 2010, that's when you had the idea, that's when the collecting of books, the buying of books for you changed, and was that was when you had the idea of doing the library in Ghana, was 2010?
Yes, it was around 2010, 2011. So that's when I would say my book buying habits kind of changed around that time, because I became more conscious of what I was buying and that I was buying for an audience that was more than myself at that point.
And While you were doing this, because I want to talk more about exactly how the library is operating there and what you're doing exactly right now, day to day, when you were in London collecting the books, what else were you doing? Were you working different jobs or had other activities going? What else was happening in 2010 when you were collecting all these books?
Yeah, so my day job is in corporate communications. So I'm actually an artist and a writer, and I was working in a 9-to-5 alongside doing my art. So my art has mainly been narrative nonfiction writing, which is where I guess the focus in books and narrative nonfiction comes from. So I was in the process of writing a book about my experiences of being a black British woman living and working in mainland Europe, which is in Brussels, where I moved to in 2010. So at that time when I was writing that book, I was also working in my day job of corporate communications and writing and collecting and doing residencies and meeting lots of people. And I guess you would say it was a day job that allowed me to be the artist at the same time. And it's the artist and the day job that's allowed me to open the library as well.
And the work that you were doing as an artist was primarily writing from 2010 on and before? Is that what your activities and your practice focused on? Or were you also performing or doing other things?
Yes, I was writing mainly, and it developed into performing around 2015, I would say, 2015-16, where I began to write a play, which has been the big piece of work for me, which is called Obama and Me, and as the title suggests, it was about me and Obama, and it looked at the parallels between Obama's 8 years in office being the first black president of the United States, and my 4 years working in mainland Europe, in Brussels, working in freedom of movement, which is a very controversial policy, and it was my job to be responsible for communicating freedom of movement around Europe. And it was a very contradictory position to be in because as a black person, a black British person, promoting the idea of free migration of workers, it was very controversial because in Europe, identity is seen as very monolithic. It's seen as very white and European. And immigration, as we know, in America and in Europe is a very controversial issue. And so here I was as this black woman talking about, you know, everybody should be able to move freely. And it was a very strange position to be in. And I was looking at what was happening with Obama in America, and I was noticing so many parallels between the experience that he was going through and the experience that I was going through. So I wrote about it. And initially, I wasn't writing it as a play. I was writing it as a book. But then as the time came nearer towards Obama's last weeks in office, I decided that actually it was kind of urgent, and I didn't have time to wait around for an agent or a publisher to publish it. So I decided to write it as a play. And I performed it, I think, on January the 1st, 2017, which was obviously a couple of weeks before Obama stood down and Trump was inaugurated. And so that was a totally different experience for me as an artist, because it was my first time as a performer. And, you know, writers are very reclusive people. We spend a lot of time in our rooms, behind our desks, alone, you know, writing our work. And all of a sudden, to be thrust into this position of performing was an interesting position for me to be in, but I felt like I had no choice at that point. So,
and so let's talk a little bit about that performance, and then we'll come back to the library and where you are now. But that performance, took a lot of bravery. That's way out of your comfort zone, it sounded like. How did the play go? What was the reaction like to that play? And it must have been also very satisfying as a writer to see work performed, literally.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. I mean, the first performance, as I said, it was like January the 3rd or the 4th or something like that. And I was literally writing until maybe 4 hours before the performance was due to start, because I'd been selected to take part in the Black Box Festival at the Etc. Theatre in London, which is an annual festival of new writing. And to be honest, I was surprised that I was chosen because I just applied for it, you know, just not thinking anything in particular. And I wrote the play perhaps 2 months before the festival was due to go ahead. So I was writing right up until the last minute, which is why I didn't actually have an actress to perform it because I was still writing it right to the end. And so when I performed it, it was more of a reading, actually. It was a reading of what I'd written. It incorporated video of key points in Obama's presidency that overlapped with my own, such as, obviously, the inauguration. There was the birther incident, and he presented his birth certificate to the press. And as a Black British woman in Europe, I was always being asked, like, where are you from? Where are you really from? And so that was a key point for me, where Obama came out to the press and said, you know, this is my birth certificate. So there was video, there was a lot of music. There was no music. There was a lot of images because it also incorporates the Black Lives Matter movement and how that fits in with the ongoing migration crisis and that's going on in Europe, or that was going on in Europe at the time, with people coming from Africa and Syria coming over to Europe. And so it connected those two things as well. So it was very visual. And actually, I remember the first time I performed it, I saw people in the audience crying because there are some powerful video and images in there. And obviously, the connections that I made were strong as well. So I saw people crying. And that, to me, was satisfying in a way. It was satisfying to know that I'd moved people in that way. And as a result of that first performance, I actually did get a theatre production company approach me afterwards, and they were interested in developing it further. So after that, I was working with Tallawa Theatre Company and a director called Jane Fallowfield. And so she took it to a whole nother level. She took it to the next level. And I worked with her intensively to make the script less literary and more theatre, basically. And it toured. I did a small tour of the UK last year, May. So the reception, as I said, has been overwhelmingly positive. I've been very moved that people have identified with it, and it's people from all backgrounds. It's not just Black British people or Black European people, although they obviously feel it more and can identify with it more. But I think anybody who feels that the world is in a place that perhaps it shouldn't be in and is going in the wrong direction can identify with it.
And that's very exciting that kind of evolved that way and then toured. After that is when, I mean, you the library project was also, I guess, developing in your mind then, and you were moving towards what you're doing now in Ghana. Did you also, when you're in Ghana now, leave the corporate communications job, or is that a kind of parallel support throughout this whole process?
Yeah, it's definitely a parallel support. So I kind of stopped full-time working about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, I would say. And I can work from anywhere in the world where I have an internet connection. So occasionally, you know, companies will approach me and ask me to do various projects, but that work definitely sustains the work of the library. How the library works is that it's a membership model where we ask people to pay 50 cedis a month, which is the equivalent of about $6 or $8 a month. It's probably about $6 a month. And we ask them to pay that money in order to help us to continue to run the library. Obviously, we pay for space, we pay for light, we pay for water and electricity. And that money goes towards that, but it's still not enough to be able to make it self-sustaining. So the work that I do in terms of corporate communications definitely subsidizes that, let's say.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So the library in Ghana, where you are now, did you had to rent or purchase a building? Because it's also fascinating how something like this develops, flourishes, and ultimately is funded. So that's kind of the membership model is very interesting to me. Tell me a little bit about how you found the building and how that was. Is it rented or owned? How did that evolve?
Yeah. It's a rented building, and I came across it totally by chance because at the time, at around that time, so I'd been in Ghana since June 2017, and I signed the lease for the library in September 2017. And originally, I was looking for a place in Cape Coast, which is the colonial capital of Ghana when the British used to rule Ghana. Cape Coast was the capital. And because of that, Cape Coast has good universities, it has good schools, and it's also the place where there are the slave, quote-unquote, castles. And so when anybody visits Ghana, they will always visit Cape Coast, as President Obama did in 2008 or 9, I think. You know, they'll come and they'll visit the castles and they'll experience going through the door of no return, and it's a very powerful experience. But unfortunately, in Cape Coast, there's nothing much else to do apart from to go to the castles. But I thought it would be a good place to have the library because of its history, but because also originally I was thinking of doing a residency, so making the library part of a residency. So I went looking for buildings in Cape Coast and I found one, but unfortunately it fell through. And so I was feeling kind of disheartened and disappointed. I was thinking maybe the library wouldn't actually happen. And then one day, the place that I rent in Accra, it's about 5 minutes or 10 minutes from where the library is, and there's a pharmacy that's in the bottom of the building. And so my mum goes to that pharmacy quite often, and one day she went there, and I was in a taxi with her, and I looked up, and I could see that there was this empty space in the building. And I wondered if it was free, and the taxi driver I was with was urging me to go and find out, go and ask the person who owns the building if that space was free. And so I went into the pharmacy. I asked the pharmacist, you know, do you know if that room is free? And he said yes. He gave me the number of the person who manages the building. And within 24 hours, I'd signed the contract for the library for 2 years. And it was very strange because after 6 years of having the idea for it, in less than 24 hours, I found a space that, you know, appeared to be ideal. And I signed the contract and that was it. So,
and what kind of a building is it? Can you describe the building a little bit? Is it, I don't know how many square feet it is, or you know, we all have images of libraries, which I do, but what does that mean? What kind of building?
Yeah, I mean, I would describe it more as a reading room than a library. So it's a two-story building, and it's an office building. And so downstairs, I think there are three offices, which are maybe, I think it's an accounting firm or an asset management firm, and then there's the pharmacy. And then upstairs, there are three other offices, and one of them is an architectural firm. Another one, I think, is another architectural firm. And then the other one is the library. And there's a courtyard right in the middle of the building, an open courtyard, which is very beautiful, and it makes the space very adaptable for the different types of events that we do. So we, like I said, we have author readings. We've also had musical performances and stuff. And what's good about it being in an office complex is that by 5 o'clock, all the other offices have gone home. All the other people in the other offices have gone. And so it means that we can use the space quite freely to do whatever we want. It's a very good space. It's a very small space in terms of the actual library itself, but we expand it by, you know, using the available space outside. And we also do lots of outreach work, as I said, which is probably the bulk of what we do now, which is creative literacy and creative writing for more vulnerable communities. Where the library is actually quite a middle-class community.
And who is we? Is there a board that runs it, or a kind of collaborative group that makes the decisions and outreach and programming? And because it sounds like it's a very active space.
Yeah, it's me, mainly myself, but my mum helps as well. I have a friend here who helps. And also, since starting the library or opening it in December 2017, we've obviously had people come through who have been very interested in the concept of it and who volunteered their time to help. So I have a friend called Seth who is actually a member of the library, and he helps me out a whole lot. So, yeah, it's a small, small team, but we do a lot.
And so this is so new. And so how from you know, the time you started the lease till now, we're in 2019. How has it grown? Are there many memberships? And is that I guess one of the markers of just how the audience, how local people are interacting with it? How is it doing right now? Compared to when you began? Does it keep growing? And does the reception seem as what you imagined it would be, or more?
I would say that the reception has definitely been overwhelming in a positive way from people from all over the world, actually. So we have quite an active Instagram page, which is where most people, I think, found out about the library from. And as a result of that, we've had people, you know, donating books, donating time, coming to visit us from all over the world simply because they saw it on Instagram or they Googled libraries in Ghana and we came up first. I mean, the thing is there aren't that many. There are libraries here, but they're not well maintained and they're not well developed. And, you know, there's a problem with literacy here, and not so much literacy as such. It's just we don't really have a reading culture, I would say. And part of the problem with that is that we don't have access to books that people would like to read. And that's become a big issue because, you know, if you want to get people to read, you want to encourage a reading culture, then you can't just rely on donated books, which is what the libraries here have mainly done. You know, they get donations of 30,000 books or however many from, you know, different organizations from around the world. And often there's a reason why books are donated. It's because people either don't want them anymore, they're not interested in them, or maybe they're clearing out their house. And so they're not necessarily culturally relevant. The interesting thing that I've discovered since opening the library is that 100% people are interested in books by African writers. And Nigeria is obviously it's a literary powerhouse in Africa. And books by Nigerian writers, books by African writers, they're always the ones that are taken out. There's never been a problem with, you know, getting people to read those kind of books. In terms of the membership is small. But what's really, really grown, I would say, more than anything else, as I said, is the outreach work, because it came to a point where I ran a crowdfunding campaign to try to raise enough money to rent the space opposite the library, to kind of knock the wall through and make one big library. And half of it would have been a children's library and half of it would have been the library that I currently have. And I set out to raise 20,000 USD and I only made 10% of that, which turned out to be a blessing, actually, and I'm glad that I didn't raise that 20,000 USD because it made me think more creatively about how to use that small pot of money. And what it made me do was to go out to the people rather than expecting the people to come to me. And so that's how the outreach program really developed. And through that, we developed a program called Market Akinkang, which in the local language tree means market reading. And so we go out to different markets around the capital, Accra, and we run reading and creative play events for the children of market women. And that's proved to be really successful. So far, we've only done one. But what we decided to do, instead of going around to different markets around the city, is to try to set up a pop-up school in the first market that we did it in to try to maximize the impact and be able to track the impact of what we did. We also do another reading event called Read Well, Look Smart, where we paired with a local hairdresser, and children who come in and read a book for half an hour then get their hair done for free. And we've also donated two smaller libraries to two different schools in underprivileged and underserved areas in the country. One of them is the Gemstar School in Ashaiman, which is, they would call it here a ghetto area. Of Accra, of Greater Accra, and the other one is in a place called Kumawu, which is in the Ashanti region, which is about 4 hours' drive from the capital, Accra. And so we have those libraries that we donated to those schools, and we go there once a month at least and do various reading and writing and creative play programs with the children. And I think it's very important that, you know, rather than just donating books and expecting children to read them, that we follow them up with the programs and with the, you know, the fun and the engagement. Otherwise, the books just stay there unread. You have to almost
And when you mentioned before market women, I don't know what that term means. I imagine that meant that these were people that that were working in a certain field and perhaps are not literate, and that was a target area. Or what does that mean, market women and the and their children?
Yep, so markets are a key feature of Ghanaian life. You know, in the West, in the UK and in the United States, obviously we go to supermarkets a lot. But in Ghana and in Africa generally, markets are where most people go to buy their food and their produce. And so market women tend to be they tend to be educated, but basically educated. And unfortunately, you get a lot of children working in the markets as well. And they do this thing called kayoyo, which is where you'll go to a market and you'll see a person, usually a woman or a girl, carrying a silver bucket. And when you go into the market, they'll ask you, do you need somebody to help you carry your things? And what they do is they'll put your purchases into this bucket, which is, like I said, it's a silver bucket. And they can be carrying things that are really heavy. So we're talking about yams and plantains and tomatoes and things like that. And they're following you around the market carrying these things on their heads. And then you would pay them for that service. And unfortunately,
so that's what the market woman is doing. She is carrying those things around for you as you shop.
Well, that's what the kayoyos are doing. So the market women are sat in their spot selling whatever they're selling. So tomatoes, plantains, yams. And then the younger children, the kayoyos, they're the ones who are following you around, you know, carrying your shopping for you as you shop.
Right. And so when you go on. So is it the kayoyos or the market women, like when you talked about, engaging them?
Yeah, so it's actually the children of the market women that we work with. So I didn't realize that some of the children who are doing the kayoyo are the children of the market women. So the first event that we did, for example, was in a market called Dome Market, which isn't far from where I live. And I go to that market quite often, but I'd never been there on a Saturday, and I'd never been there during a holiday period. But I went there sometime in early January, so it was still Christmas holidays, the children were off school, and it was a busy market day. And as I was walking around, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and it was one of the girls who came to our market reading event, because the market reading event that we did for the people who work in that market wasn't actually held in the market. There is a mall that's nearby, and they kindly gave us a space to hold the event there. So we hired what are called trotros, which are minibuses, to take the children from the market to the mall and then to take them back again. So I'd never actually seen these children in their natural environment, which was in the market. I'd just seen them at the mall for the event. But as I was walking around the market in January, there was a tap on my shoulder, and it was one of the girls who'd come to the market reading event, and she'd remembered me. And so I asked her, you know, have you continued to read? You know, have you been writing? We had a short conversation. And it dawned on me that she was actually doing the kayoyo. She was in the market working, whereas I'd only ever seen her, as I said, as a school child doing reading exercises at the event that we did at the mall. So that actually shocked me quite a bit. Maybe that was a bit of naivety on my part. I don't know. But I didn't actually think that the children of the market women were working in the market itself. I thought, you know, I mean, I know most of them do go to school. That's one thing. Most of them do go to school, but after school and on the weekends, they're helping their mothers in the market.
Right. Wow. So this is, to step back from this all, the bigger picture, you're an artist, a writer, playwright. You're now involved in this kind of tremendous educational initiative. I guess my two questions are, where is this going from here? Is this going to keep growing? And, you know, how is this affecting your own writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one I've been thinking about a lot, because definitely my experiences here over the last 18 months have opened my eyes to things that I never thought that they would. And I have a lot to write about, actually, now. You know, when I think about the different situations that I've encountered, not only with the market women, but with the children in the schools in Ashaiman, I see that there's a lot of potential here. And it's a lot of potential that's unfortunately been stifled. But I've learned a lot from them. And I definitely think that there are things that I need to kind of meditate on and work out. And the way that I do that is through writing. And who knows, perhaps at the end of this, you know, there'll be some kind of work, whether it'll be a play or a book or something. But definitely I think there are stories here that need to be told and that deserve to be told. So, yeah, I'm willing to see what happens.
That's exciting, and it seems to me also that, I mean, my perspective on this and what you're doing, the whole initiative as it's growing, it's a project that potentially changes lives, right? We all know stories of people who have read a book or been exposed to a book that changed what they were seeing, that changed the possibilities that they may have thought, you know, they could execute, that there's, you know, that there's many ways you can live and be. I mean, I guess I'm trying to say it seems like it's an enormously liberating and empowering project.
For sure. And definitely I see that with the children that we work with, especially at the schools, because, as I say, we go there at least once a month, and it's so rewarding, you know, when a child comes up to you and they say, you know, I've read this book, and where is the next one, you know? You know, it's amazing to me how powerful, and I'll name the book, you know, the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series is, because we have children who come into the library, and, you know, my friends in London will always ask me, how do they know about Diary of a Wimpy Kid? How do they know about the Dork Diaries and these different books? And of course they know about them, because, you know, they're exposed to things through television, through the internet, and through these various things. Unfortunately, they've just not been exposed to the books. And so to me, it's, you know, it's amazingly powerful that children, they'll run in and they'll say, you know, I just read this book, where is the next one? Or, you know, I've set myself a challenge to read 5 books a week, as this child at the Gemstar School said to me. And these are children who have gone from reading, you know, practically 0 books to now reading 4 or 5 books a week, you know. And what more can you ask for at the end of the day?
Yeah, that's just amazing. And to ask a little bit about the content itself, and this is one of the last questions, but Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which, of course, I know very well about because I have a son, it's also, that would seem kind of culturally specific in terms of the children's experience at an American school. Is it not that case? Is it more universal than I'm thinking?
I would say it's a whole lot more universal because, as I say, you know, it is the number one book that I'm asked for by children, and that's by children in Accra, by children in Ashaiman, and by children in Kumawu in the Ashanti region. And there's something about that book that connects with these children. And I was asking one of the parents who comes to the library regularly with her children about it, and she said, they're funny books. You know, she said, they're funny, and that's it.
It's wonderful. It's so exciting that you're doing this, and it's been great talking to you. I want to ask you one more question.